Welcome to Grails, a podcast by Alton Insights. My name is John Tunger, and on this episode, we're joined by Ryan Nolan, aka Breakout Cards. And if you're someone who's looking to dive deep into the world of sports cards, learn more, or maybe you just geek out on this stuff, this is a great episode for you. We talk a ton about grading cards, how you can even spot fakes as you're looking for your own grails. Ryan talks a ton about different sport card shows, where the best shows are at, how you can approach shows, look for great cards, just a ton of great stuff. So without further ado, an interview with Ryan Nolan. Let's get started.
Yeah, so I lucked out. My dad owned a LCS in the 90s, the other boom for this hobby. And unfortunately, his shop was running out of business. He sold all of his cards. He sold the shop itself to the other owner and quit the hobby, walked away. Well, I was born. Guess what? I'm an excuse to go back and join the hobby he once loved, to go back to card shows, to go back to the flea markets and, you know, rebuild that collection ground up. So I started from a really, really young age. I mean, I opened up packs when I was early elementary schools. I would go to some of the card shows in malls and flea markets. My LCS growing up was in the Oldsmar flea market, which the guy is literally still here to this day. I saw him a few weeks ago when I went back to a card show over there. It's crazy. This guy's been here probably 30 plus years. He's changed location throughout the building, but like this guy loves cards so much. He just stays there and it's for the people, for him rather than the cardboard. But like, I'm very lucky. I've been in cards for such a while. I've seen, you know, the birth of the, I wouldn't say the birth, but like, where the card shows came from 10 plus years ago, where it was all older people at shows going through dime boxes, quarter boxes. You know, we didn't see people going around with the cases of $10, $40, $50,000 plus, people having in their display case six-figure cards or like holy grails. I started from the beginning where it was a very like entry-level card base. And no, I continued to go through cards for quite a while, all the way through high school and college. And when I graduated in college with an electrical engineering degree, I had a friend, Steven, in Night Runners. We both ran in college, and he also collected sports cards. And I thought it'd be kind of cool to have another hobby where it would be filming the Florida card shows, because no one was doing it at the time. I know there's other people recording card show vlogs throughout the country. I remember watching like Card Collector and a few other people record the National, and I think Sasha T was doing some stuff as well out in California, but no one was hitting up the Florida card scene. So we decided to build out Breakout Cards to just go over and record the Florida shows and, you know, educate people a little bit on the vintage side of things, because that's what I really enjoyed card wise. And we just shot the Florida shows for a bit. One day at a Orlando show, someone said I should go to Texas and for the big Dallas card show. I had no idea that existed. From talking to dealers at the Florida scene, I knew about stuff like Chantilly. I knew about the Philly, and I went to the National a few years earlier. So I was like, all right, well, that's kind of cool. I really didn't expect to go to Texas, but because of like a very cheap Spirit flight, I think it was like $50 or $60 to go to Texas. I was like, all right, what's the worst case that's going to happen? I'm out a $60 flight. I'm out a $100 hotel room. Like, okay, it's a very, very cheap vacation. Plus this was during COVID, so like no one was traveling. Everything was dirt cheap compared to where it is today. And I was like, all right, I'm going to do that. So I ended up going to Dallas. We uploaded the card show video after, literally the best video on the channel already. So I was like, all right, I got to go back to Dallas. And I wasn't even thinking about any other card shows. I was like, all right, Florida card shows, Dallas. Did Dallas, I think, two more times. And someone told me about this big vintage card show in Wisconsin Dells. All right, this is pretty far away from me. I'm going to go to Wisconsin this time. I love vintage cards. There I ended up doing a few different trades throughout card shows, but I was able to pick up a Jim Brown 5 rookie, which, you know, from trading itself is phenomenal. But that show I did extremely well. And guess what? That card show video did great. Not as much as the Dallas card show videos did, but like performed exceptionally better than my Florida shows. So
what
I
is
decided,
great when you're saying,
you
know,
I'm just gonna start
what
traveling.
Is, what is great? Is that like a couple thousand?
I mean, no, I had like 10,000 views around. I mean, I could check right now, but I think that's where it's around. What's weird about card show vlogs is when I started building out content, I thought it'd be more like travel vlogs where they'd continue to get views over time. What I realize is they're very reactional based. You're going to get a bunch of views the first month and then people don't care about it. Even if it's a show that's once a year, it's the weirdest trend, because if you look at how like travel vlogs work out, someone goes to, let's say, Bali 5 years from now, that video will sometimes be in your recommended feed and people are continuing to watch it. You can see the views increase, but for the card show videos, for some reason in our niche, they get a lot of views up front and then they stop and people don't get views that much anymore. I've noticed that a lot with my data trends. I mean, sometimes you'll see spikes before a show, like someone will go back and watch some of the Dallas card show videos, or like for let's say some other shows, like local shows, you'll notice you'll get a little bit of uptick right before that show happens. But it's not really as a continual views as you would think it is. Wow. But those videos started doing well. And from there, that year, I'd say later down the road, I was on another podcast talking about all the card shows I was going to. And this was right after one weekend I went to the Dallas and Atlanta card shows. So mind you, I work Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. I still traveled to Dallas for a show. Then I traveled from Dallas to Atlanta, and then Atlanta back to Orlando, and then I go back to work 8 a.m. So we're talking about like how many card shows I was going to this year. And I think I was past 30 at this point. And a thought came across my head. I'm like, man, I can do 52 card shows this year, because I do multiple card shows in a weekend. One time I did 3 shows within one day all across Florida. There's a show in Orlando, show on the East Coast of Florida, West Coast, back to Orlando. Wow. Like, I'm trying to hit up as many shows, make some pretty cool content across the way. And a thought came across my mind, like, man, I'm going to do 52 this year. And that's what I ended up doing. I ended up going to, I think I ended up last year, 14 or 15 states, traveled all across the country, seeing card shows, seeing the differences between shows in the Northeast or the Midwest or the South, and built up a PC, flipped some cards, and started building out connections and had fun with it. Hit the 52 shows. And once that goal is done, I'm like, man, I need to do another card show goal. And I decided I'm going to do all 50 states. So right now I'm at 19 states. I'm going to finish number 20 this weekend in Arkansas. But yeah, I mean, it's a grind. But
so what, are you just reaching out to people on Twitter and you're like, what show to go to in Arkansas? Like, let me know. Like, how do you know what's the go-to, like when to go to it?
Honestly, some of it's that, some of it's watching YouTube videos. So I'll literally look up sometimes, like, for example, I went to this card shop show in Michigan. I saw another YouTuber Legends Up North or something like that, or Up North Legends or something like that. No, Up North Collector. And the show was at the Legends card shop. And I watched his card show vlog and I was like, all right, this is decent. I have no idea how big this show is going to be, because usually card shop shows are like 10 tables, 20 tables. I literally booked a flight from Orlando to Michigan to go see the show. It ended up being a pretty good one. Sometimes at those local shows, you can do better than the national shows because dealers are super loose. They're like, all right, I don't care. I made enough money on it. They're not like, I want 100% comp. I'm not going to go anything else. Some of these dealers are like, oh, I already made $40, $50 on this card. I can let it go. So you have the opportunity sometimes, but it's pretty fun doing that side of things.
Yeah. I was watching your channel, and what's fun is it seems like you're like, dude, this is like an amazing vintage show or something like that. It seems like you'd love to chase after those vintage cards. Is that kind of like, that's your go-to?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of vintage, pre-war, and some other rare or non-sports. I don't really highlight as much non-sports on the channel just because I go after a lot of niche stuff. And what tends to happen is when I post stuff, a lot of my subscribers try to buy out what I go after. And when there's only so many on eBay and you have limited funds, unfortunately, you get outbid by your subscribers. So that happened to me with cricket cards. Cricket cards were very cheap and I talked about them in a few videos, and now I have subscribers that outbid me on all that stuff. And now I'm like, I can't talk about what I buy.
You're not quite like, you need like that inflection of YouTube subscribers going up, so your AdSense dollars go up. And then at some point you hit that inflection where you can just like shout it out or something.
The hard part is balancing everything, because as AdSense goes up, then you're like, it's kind of like the Mr. Beast thing where if he makes more money, he wants to spend more money on whether it's production or video ideas. And that's like my side of things too. Like, anytime I make more money, I want to upgrade the equipment. I want to put more money into working with, like, now I have an editor. I used to edit all my card show videos. Now I work with an editor, give them direction and upload clips and work with them. But now I have that side of things. Now I have a Clips channel, which I have someone that does that and takes all my videos and sets up clips. So it's like everything I'm working on the YouTube side of things, I want to put back into it so I can be able to scale it out.
Wow. So it sounds like you're running hard with content. Is that kind of like the long term? You'd be like, I'd love to build up more of a content presence in this game.
Absolutely. And that even comes back to the book that I wrote last year too, which was Spotting Fakes.
You're better at transitions than me. Talk about Spotting Fakes. That's exactly where I was going.
Yeah. So like with Spotting Fakes, I knew there was a need in the hobby for someone to go out there and talk about fake sports cards, because I got burned myself and I thought I had a pretty good experience within cards with my education. Yep. And I know a lot of new people got into the hobby, whether it was COVID or saw money opportunities recently. And, you know, people go into the game spending 5-6 figures on cards, but they can't tell you if a card is real or fake. Prime example, if you go on some marketplaces online, you type in Michael Jordan rookie or Gaudi Ruth, you're going to find a ton of fake cards that people are bidding thousands and thousands of dollars for, and couldn't even tell you if this card was real or fake. They literally just know from other people or images online, oh, this is a card to go after. I'm going to do it. And if they saw a T206 Hannes Wagner on those marketplaces, raw, they'd bid for it as well. But I decided that I was going to write that book after I got burned. I started educating myself. And as I traveled card shows as well, I saw fake sports cards. I talked to dealers that been in the game for 30, 40 years that saw sports cards that were fake, that had literally collections of fake sports cards. I literally went through this guy's collection that had 100 plus examples that he got from consignments through other stuff that he sent in from people, because he did a lot of bulk subs to PSA and would sell the cards for people. And over time, and he was a vintage dealer, over time, a lot of cards would come back as like, this is a fake card. So he just kept them all in a box. I was able to see all those, document those. I saw so many different examples online as well. People were trying to sell things as quote unquote reprints, or, you know, oh, this is a handmade art card on Etsy or other marketplaces online. So I literally just documented this type of stuff, and same with like the fake slabs, started seeing some of those pop up, whether at card shows or just online. Blow up forums also started posting it. So I literally just researched it as much as I can. Saw some articles that professional graders put out in the past talking about different types of alterations, different type of things to look out on fakes. And I just accumulated all that information. And I don't know, almost every day during work, lunch, I would start writing the book. And me and my friend Steven, who started Breakout On, like would spend an hour every day at least writing and editing that. And plus when I got home, I had extra free time after editing or free time at night, worked on that book pretty much for an entire year to get it out.
I mean, so at some point you just became obsessed with figuring out how to like spot fakes and this kind of stuff, right? Like that's like such an interesting niche to be like, I'm going to double down on this. Would you say that you're at this point like almost comparable to a grader at one of these companies?
I look, I would say I'm not, just because the opportunity to technology and resources that they have. A lot of people don't realize like these grading companies have thousands and thousands of images of scans of, and plus the equipment opportunities where like you should be able to determine if a card is real or fake 100% of the time. And I'm literally here just using a loop or a black light, which don't get me wrong, they're great tools. You can determine pretty much 99.9% of the stuff, but I don't have the resources that professional graders do. Literally just a guy in my bedroom teaching people what I know from others.
And when it comes to grading, do you have any hot takes there? Are you like, or are you like, hey, PSA is your favorite? What's your grading company of choice?
Honestly, I kind of like four big companies, PSA, SGC, BGS, and CSG. And the reason is because all those graders have been in the game for a long time. They have authority at all of those companies. I'm not too much of a fan of startup companies just because they don't have the reference materials or the technology to be out there. I mean, the startup companies that I see that are being created overnight, there's fakes that get passed, there's altered
cards.
Some of
those HGA Twitter posts are kind of scary.
Yeah, I mean, and the fact that people are going to spend thousands of dollars on a Wayne Gretzky Opeachy rookie that doesn't have the dot on the shoulder tells you enough about the company. Like, that's the most obvious fake out there on hockey cards. And there's fakes that even have the dot on the shoulder, yet that's going to somehow pass authentication. Go stick with the main companies. The biggest thing about grading, and it's transformed over the years. Number one, it should be about the authenticity of the card, and it should be the grade second, because anyone can grade a card and put a number on it. Not everyone can authenticate.
So like I'm like I love cards. I've got some behind me here. There's one up there that's like a nice Jalen Hurts that I'm just like living on a prayer that he'll be good. I kind of went really hard into him this last year and it was sort of a joke now, but next year is his year for sure. But like when I bought that one of those cards, it cost almost $4,000. And that was scary because I'm sitting here like, how do I know if this is fake or not? Right. Like I'm like trying to find other versions that are out there sold on eBay. And I'm still 90% sure it's real, but like there is still that uncertainty. Like how can someone who's maybe newer or something even have some level of confidence that they're not getting a fake? What's some best practices?
Yeah. So the biggest thing, it depends if you're really going into the vintage side of things or modern. There's a lot more fakes on the modern side than, or not, sorry. There's a lot more fakes on the vintage side than there is on the modern side thing. And that's just because the technology that's been implemented, there are fakes in the 90s, but like the cards from 2020, 2021, 22, like the fakers aren't over there yet. The biggest thing that I've seen, at least on the fake modern side of things, is Panini has some inserts that look like the same as the autograph editions as well between the base, and they just put a sticker auto on it. So what some people are doing is they're going to forge the autograph. They either take a real autograph off of a card, they wipe it clean and put a fake autograph of, let's say, like a Tom Brady on there, and then reapply it to a base Tom Brady card. And what they also do is they flip over the card in the back and they put a fake COA on it. Sometimes the grading companies, they fell for it because they see a sticker auto, they see the COA, and the sticker is the same that Panini uses.
Wow.
So they look at it like, you know, this has a sticker on it, we're going to assume it's real, and has a COA on it, but the COA has been printed after. So that's the biggest thing to look for, at least on the modern side of things, are the sticker autos. They do it to also printing plates and like base and parallel versions. So be careful with that side of things. Also patch swapping. I don't have the money to spend into a six-figure RPA, but when you get to that really high threshold, people sometimes try to swap patches because if you have a three-color patch and you have a logo, if you have the logo of a team or like a single-color patch and you can turn that into two or three colors, that's a big price difference because people at that type of tier pay for presentation. I mean, obviously with lower-end patches, that does happen as well, but when you're talking about six figures, a difference between a two-color patch and a three-color or two and a four could be thousands upon thousands of dollars. So people, and it's not a new phenomenon. I mean, this has been happening since the 2000s, but it's really been elevated with the prices of the cards. And if you go on the vintage side of things, the biggest thing that happens, and I know we don't see video here, but people make photocopy cards and it's really touch on them because the stock is way off. You can also use a tool like a black light since the ink is going to be different. They're going to go really bright like a modern card versus a vintage card, which won't be bright under a black light. If you compare a vintage card 60s, 50s compared to a card of today, they aren't going to bright up. The card of today is going to be super, super bright. If you have a loop as well, you can look under the print dots as well. It's kind of complicated to talk about over audio rather than seeing it in person. The thickness of stock is also different from different years. If you have a flashlight, you can put it towards the back of the card. A lot of modern cards, light goes all the way through versus some of the cards in the past, like a Galdian 33, there should be no light that goes through it. I mean, there's so many different tools that you can have in your arsenal before purchasing these cards. If you don't know, stick with something that's been graded, pay a little bit more just because it's been authenticated. Not to say every card that's gone through a grading company is 100% authentic because they do make mistakes. They are human. I mean, if a company stops 99.99%, which sounds great, that means there's still a lot of fakes that are going through. So you always have to double check. Plus the other thing to be careful for is there's now fake slabs. They've affected some of the different Tom Brady cards out there and LeBron James's and some Michael Jordan's. So if you want to confirm your PSA slab, there's 10 or 11 different designs of PSA slabs, which kind of make it a little bit confusing. Right. But a quick tip that I'd recommend, and literally we could talk an hour plus over fake slabs or anything that we talked about, but is to look up a serial number close to the slab you're getting because they're not going to change the design of the slab from 10 or 50 digits. So if you look up another slab nearby, see if there's been a sold listing within the last few years and compare the slabs. Look at the corners, look at how the fonts are, look at the spacing, look at the encapsulation. You'll notice like if everything really lines up. And if you notice it in person as well, the fake slabs I've noticed aren't sonically willed. They crack if you put it next to your ear. It's often you can put a fingernail underneath them as well. And they have a super, super slippery surface compared to a PSA one.
What is the best fake that you've seen that you're just like, I don't know, and then it came out being a fake?
Oh, man. The best fake. I mean, there's a lot of good fakes out there. I'd say the one that's really fooled the most people in the hobby is the Kobe Ovations autograph. Okay. And here's the reason why. It looks like a real card. There's a signature that is on card and there's foil on the back. So a lot, and this happened at the Dallas Card Show. I don't want to talk about the whole situation that happened because the person that ended up selling the card didn't know better. Like he actually genuinely thought it was a real card.
No, but, let's tell the story because I think lot of our listeners might not know.
Yeah. A good story. But yeah, so the Kobe Ovations auto, what happened with it is someone has it printed out. They sign it with a fake Kobe autograph and there's foil in the back. And there's a little bit slight differences in the coloring. The autograph is way off, but most people look at the card. They look at that there's an autograph on it. There's a COA and there's foil and they assume that it's real. However, people completely fake the card. A lot of parts are built from scratch. So you really have to know like the colors on the card. You have to know what a Kobe autograph looks like from 2002, which makes it difficult because now for a collector, you're going to have to look at the autographs on some of these cards and really have to authenticate those as well as the card. It's become
what
a
happened
mess.
At the card show though, right? Was that the one where the guy got like tackled and everyone thought he was trying to like selfie?
No, that was actually with fake slabs, and those guys sold fake slabs across multiple card shows, 5 or 6 card shows across the United States. I can't legally talk about everything that's happening because there's stuff going on behind the scenes with PSA and authorities, but they sold cards across like 5 different states.
You're involved with this? You can't legally talk about it?
Well, like I've had conversations with PSA behind closed doors where I can't really talk about the whole situation and what's going on.
All right. But,
I helped determine that those cards were fake in Dallas with the one video, and then other people confirmed it as well.
That is amazing. Wow. Love it. Deep in the scenes. It's pretty fun that you're becoming like a go-to source for kind of like the everyday collector out there.
I'm trying. And it's not just about like fake sports cards, because I don't want to be known as like the guy that just talks about fake cards in the hobby. Like I really want to educate people on like vintage sports cards, oddball stuff as well, and show people that there's more than just a 2018 or 2019 Prism card out there that you can put your money to or like enjoy. Feels like so many people are focused on releases within the last 5 years and don't even realize cards go all the way back from 1887, earlier if you count cabinet cards. Again, a whole another debate that could be well over an hour or not if cabinet cards count as a specific trading card release, but all the way from 1887. And you know, it goes across every major sport, including stuff like cricket, which people don't know about in the US. Unfortunately, I've talked about too much, so people were outbid me on that stuff. But, and also non-sports releases, like music's pretty fun as well. And there's so much more to enjoy if you do your own research on it.
Yeah, I really need to start branching out to some of that. I know you bought like some actor cards or something one of your last videos. That was pretty awesome.
So I have some actor stuff. I have a big music collection as well, which I really enjoy. And the thing about like actors, music, and like cricket, boxing, all that type of stuff, it's not all the information is out there. You know, you can't go out there, look up a YouTube video and all right, I know everything about this information, or watch someone opening up a box. Like, okay, here's the main people, or go put on TV and see everyone that you should know. Like you actually have to go through, read about the historical events. You have to read about different players. Then you have to go back and figure out the sets. I mean, like with cricket, I thought some cards were rookie cards. Like 3 or 4 times I find out a player has a card that's 3 or 4 years earlier. Find out he has another card that's earlier, another specific release that's harder to find. And it's like, it's a never ending research process. And that's the fun part about collecting. You know, it's so much more than just being given the information. It's really deep dive in the research side of it. It's so much fun.
Are you, when it comes to like a lot of like the investor class of the hobby, is that something that you're kind of like, reluctant to? Is it like, okay, well, I guess it's like a necessary evil?
No, so I think it's a good thing that you have more blood in the hobby. So many people are like, oh, I hate all these people going into the hobby, or I hate investors. But if you look at all the cards that you have, they've gone up in value. Are you going to be really mad that your card that was worth $20 a year ago is now worth $500? You shouldn't be. You should be thrilled. yes, I understand if you're trying to build a PC and your cards are really expensive. Hell, I'm mad that I get outbid on some of my Cricket stuff and my other PCs that I go for. But at the end of the day, like if you look at the values across like everything that you own, they're up because of new people entering the hobby. Plus, if there's not new blood entering the hobby, how are you going to enjoy it with other people? So many times I heard before like the hobby boom, oh, there's no young kids in the hobby. All it is old people. And now that there's young people in the hobby or investors also in the hobby, people are complaining about them. Like people are going to complain about no matter what happens with the hobby, there's always going to have to be some talking point. But in my opinion, there always needs to be new blood going in here because you have new ideas, you have new opportunities and new thought processes. I mean, without some of the newer people going to card shows across the country, I mean, I didn't get that idea from people in the past. I saw YouTubers going to the national and recording card show vlogs or people recording some of the California card shows. And that's literally one of the reasons why I got into content, someone that was newer into the hobby, not someone that's been there for 40, 50 right. years.
I can't even imagine being a young kid trying to get into the hobby. That'd be nuts. You're like, how do you do that? You spend all, you save up all of your, all of like your work money, and all of a sudden all you can do is what, buy a content, what, I forget what it's called, something in stars, like the basic, you know. But then even then, like, can you find those in Target? No,
you would be surprised, man. Some of those kids are hustlers. So like when I was in the Montana card show, I'd say like 30% of the card show there were kids with their dads, but those kids were wheeling and dealing, man. Like there's 14, 15 year olds with their carrying cases going table to table. Will you buy this? Flipping at the show. And a lot of it's kind of cool to see too. I'll do Montana as an example because I was just over there and it sounds crazy. Like a card show in Montana, are you kidding me? Like this just shows you like how far the hobby has gone. I mean, my card shows when I was a kid were literally flea markets in Florida in the summer with no fans and like boxes everywhere. Now we have card shows in Montana. Like people complain about the hobby. I'm thrilled that we have shows literally all across the US. But like that show, for example, had a scavenger hunt for kids to go across the different tables and had dealers sign off, like if they had a card on their display, which is awesome because it gets them engaged. Then they had a giveaway at the end for all the kids that entered. They had like a Panini loot box that they like Panini gave them or something. And they gave that away as well. A lot of the dealers were asking kids to go on their table, hey, what's your favorite player or what's your favorite team or sport? And gave them free cards or mystery packs. Like, I think that's the best way to engage. Like if you have a table at a show and you have the budget that allows it, get the kids in there, because 5 years or 10 years, if that kid's still in the hobby, they're going to come back to you and realize, hey, you know, you supported me when I was a kid. I'm going to support your table again. You don't know what happens because like, it's crazy. Some of these 22, 23 year olds out there that flip six figure cards.
It's wow. Insane. I can't even imagine. I mean, this is good. If you're okay, listeners, I have so many like base, not just totally throwaway base. I've got some like decent football, like more modern cards would love to give away. This is just random as we're talking that like, honestly, I don't know if I'm going to do the work to go through and sell them for like a couple bucks each or all that kind of stuff. I'll send you big lots if you just Twitter, DM or something, say, hey, I got a kid. I don't know, but don't scam me. I don't want that. But like, and then I would love to send it to your kid. Yeah, that's just crazy. I'm excited for the future of it, though. It's going to be awesome. Okay, so for, let's say for the two big markets here, so California and New York, if you know this. So I'm in California. I want to know, like, what is a show that I need to go to that you've kind of heard about in the wind? What's a California show that I need to hit?
Oh, man, so I've only gone to one California show, and I don't want to throw them under the bus, but that show was so crammed. Like, a lot of the shows, at least, like, East Coast, Northeast, you have your opportunities to walk through aisles. I'm here with my camera. I can barely walk through the aisles because the things are like literally my desk is like this right over here. There's barely enough room for people to walk by. It was jam packed. Don't get me wrong.
Which I was about to give you a hard time. You're like, so you're just saying there's too much hype in California for this stuff? No, but you're just saying it was not set up well.
No, I'm saying the one show I went to in California, like there was zero space to walk around. Like it was really, really uncomfortable. So, the California scene though, at least from talking to people, is always going to be modern cards. So if you're a vintage guy, There's one show I think that PSA owns. It's like, man, what is the show called? I can't remember. There's like one very vintage heavy show. It's also a coin show as well out there in California. Mm-hmm. But from what I've seen on YouTube and from what I've heard from a lot of other collectors, it's mostly a modern show base. There's also a big show in San Francisco. I went to one in LA, but the San Francisco show, it's about 300 tables. They have a trade night. I know Mojo Sports always does videos on it. I haven't watched that show yet. It's something I'll eventually go out there. But being from Florida, it's such a pain to get out to California and back. Last time that I went to LA, it literally turned into a 24-hour trip. I don't want to pay for a hotel. So yeah. I literally flew the earliest flight from Florida all the way over there, went to the card show, hanged out with one of my friends, got a sightsee around LA, and then took the last flight from LA back to Florida, 24 hours in general, slept on the flight, and called it a day.
I'm 15 minutes away from SF. I got extra bedrooms with your name on it. You can just come and hang if you want to go to a card show. Don't pay for those crazy prices. What about New York? What's like a go-to show for the listener from New York?
Yeah, so New York is a lot more vintage based, but the problem is you're going to be paying New York prices on it. So if you're looking to make some money at the show, it's pretty tough because a lot of dealers there are firm on their prices. Also, good luck buying any Mickey Mantle cards because they're double or triple any costs.
Dang, I feel like there's a story there, but
no, like I don't want to shit on shows because I think it's really important to have them in communities. But what I found, at least from my personal opinion, is like when you're next to a major markets, dealers don't have to give as many deals. Yeah. Versus, at least for me, when I go to some like smaller areas or places where there's more like flexible room, you can find deals. Like Dallas is a mecca for deals because everyone flies into Dallas all across the country. It's not just like people having the best Dallas inventory there. Like you're going to have people from California, people from Florida, people from New York, people from Montana, Arkansas, Kansas, wherever. They're all going to fly into Dallas and set up. So you have that opportunity. Sometimes when you get into these LA shows or New York shows, you just have the people that are specific to that region. And the price is already really expensive because the cost of living there is super expensive. So they have to make their money on it.
Yeah. I mean, if I go to a LCS here in the Bay, I mean, I might as well just go to eBay, right? Like for a box, like boxes are 25% over comps. I'm just like, I'm going to buy it off eBay.
And that's a tough part because like you want to enjoy the show, but at least for me, like I have to make a little bit of money just to cover the expenses between the flight, any of the food, Ubers, and you know, like at least it'd be nice to come out with a show with a little bit of profit at the end of the day. I don't care if I break even or not. It's the experience plus building out more content, but you do have to make money.
Anything else you want to hit? We talked about spotting fakes. You should get a copy of that. I mean, especially if you're getting some higher end stuff, just to have a good eye for it. But anything else for the people before we head out here?
Oh man. Let's see. We could, talk a little bit more about the different types of areas throughout the country, like card show scene wise, like what you could expect.
Yeah. Okay. So those are for the two big markets. What are some areas kind of around the US, that do they have like different trends when it comes to card shows? What are you seeing?
So Midwest, you're going to find a ton of vintage. So if you're like a big vintage collector, go to the Midwest, specifically Ohio. Yeah. So Ohio's like a big vintage threshold. Those shows are always like really, really heavy on it. Plus there's some regional releases in that area too. So a lot of the collectors, full set collectors and everything like that, tons of raw opportunities. The difference between like a smaller show as well, like a local show or a national show. So national shows, you're going to see slabs in every showcase. You're going to find those 5 and 6 figure cards. More the local side of things, you're going to find raw cards and more opportunities to buy cards where you can grade it. Everyone at the national scene that has cards in their showcase, they already know what cards they should be able to grade and what cards they aren't. So if they're raw in their showcase, there's a reason for that. At a local show, these guys don't care, right? Like they bought a card for $80. If they want to sell it for $110, make $30, they're not going to deal with grading. They're not going to wait a year or 6 months or pay that $50 to get it back faster. They just want to make that extra bit of money, and that card could become a 10. So if you're looking for opportunities to buy raw and then grade it local as well on that side of things, like local, I've noticed dealers don't care as much as like making money. They have a lot more room on even the slab side of things. So you can bulk a lot better at those type of shows rather than some of the like larger shows. So another scene as well as Northeast, a lot of vintage, but there's also a lot of hockey there. There's parts of the country where there's no hockey, but in the Northeast specifically, kind of like around the Boston area, you notice ton of hockey cards.
Wow.
And it goes back with like the original cities where hockey originated in the US. You're going to find those type of cards. Soccer is pretty big in Florida. There's a big scene as well that's starting up in Dallas. I know they have like a soccer trade night that people are putting on. So I've seen that happen over there. But the Florida shows, there's always like three or four dealers here, at least at the local shows, that are really bringing in soccer. So I've seen that happening over the year or two. It's funny, like no one cared about F1, and then all of a sudden you see F1 at almost every show. There's not as much as you would see like on social media, everyone posting it, but there's always a decent amount.
Now everyone's like WWE. Other, like,
let's say one or two dealers.
I'm like, come on. F1, WWE. I said, now everyone's talking about WWE. It's like, okay, I don't know.
It's going to be funny though, because if WWE ends up going to all the different shows, but you know, all those people going after WWE, they probably have no idea that wrestling cards have been around since 1887 as well. Like some of those old wrestling cards are so cool.
Right. Man. Like, yeah. Yeah. Ryan, it's been super fun. We're going to have to, when you get some big hits at shows, you got to come back on and talk about it. Where are some places that people can find you? Shout out the social channels.
Yeah, so my YouTube channel is Breakout Cards. I used to upload 4 videos a week over there, and I decided I'm going to diversify the content. On my main channel, I'm only going to have the card show vlogs. It's kind of like the bread and butter. I also have a second channel, which I just launched about a week ago, and that's Breakout Cards Deep Dive. So you can find a lot more information on there, like my whole series on the personal collection where I interviewed a collector every week about cards that they PC, ranging awesome. From modern all the way to pre-war, and also my Spotting Fake series, which is going to be on that channel. I have a Clips channel on YouTube as well if you want to watch short form content. Super active on Twitter, Breakout Cards as well, and I do have an Instagram that I'm semi-active on.